This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with John Prisco from Quantum Exchange.
Hi, how are you? Quantum Exchange is a quantum key distribution network, and it's the first commercial offering of quantum cryptographic keys in the United States.
We've heard a lot about quantum keys over the last 3-4 years, but it's always been one of those topics that people have been very unsure of because of the challenges and how realistically it can be monetized and productized. Can you give us a quick view of what those big challenges are?
I think we should start first with the medium that we're using to transport quantum keys, and that's optical fiber. Starting back in the mid-80s, the United States began a competitive telecommunications business, which lasted for about 20 years. During that time, a lot of optical fiber was constructed throughout the United States. Consequently, there's a tremendous glut of optical fiber throughout the country. And that optical fiber is perfectly fine for transmitting quantum keys. So what we've done is we've purchased spare optical fiber from companies that are in business to sell off that surplus. So it was a very inexpensive approach to laying about 1,000 kilometers of optical fiber, which our company now controls. And we didn't actually lay any of it. We just bought it because it had already been constructed. Think about 1,000 kilometers. Well, one of the issues that people have discussed since quantum keys became available in 1984 is the idea that the key can only travel about 100 kilometers. So the first issue we had to solve was, how do we get the keys to travel in unlimited distance? And we did this through research with a number of research organizations, and we sponsored that research and came up with a way that we're able to essentially repeat the signal without affecting the quantum state of the photons that make up the key. And that's a pretty important breakthrough. And we really do this by wrapping the quantum key that's sort of at the end of its journey with a new quantum key that has full energy and is able to then transport the combined key the next 100 kilometers. And you do this over and over again until you reach your destination.
So it's kind of like Russian dolls.
Yes, in fact. It's sort of giving a piggyback ride to the quantum key that doesn't have very much energy left in it.
But one of the things we've been telling people ever since we've talked about quantum keys is look for that degradation point, look for that change in the original key. As you wrap and retransmit, how do you ensure that there is no change to the original key and then maybe the second key and the third and the fourth and the fifth, depending upon the distance? Because at some point somebody's got to unpack this and still trust that the original key is the original key.
Basically, we're using a one-time pad at each one of the repeater points, and no matter how many times you're going to repeat the key, you can reverse that at the end and get the original key back. That's part of the technique, and it keeps things straight. And another thing to consider is that, yes, at some point you have plain text within the device, but when you consider the way telecommunications works today, optical fiber is completely exposed for its entire distance. And it's very easy to tap an optical fiber. So let's say, for example, you wanted to take 10% of the light out of an optical fiber. You just simply bend it with a device that has a detector built into it, and you can basically take every bit of data streaming over that fiber. The troubling part is that no one can actually detect the fact that you stole 10% of the light. That means that if you have a transcontinental 33,000-mile optical fiber, it's exposed all throughout the route. What we're doing is reducing that attack surface in a device that has a cryptographic boundary that's been sanctioned by NIST as being safe, and only creating several repeat points over that same route. It's a much more secure process than the one we're dealing with every day now.
You're talking earlier about the fact you've bought up this fiber and you're now working on a set of routes that you own. How do you expand that from being point to point with a set of repeaters where maybe you can change the direction at each repeater to a much wider network that might not be wholly owned by you, where actually you might just be leasing the fiber or you might be moving onto somebody else's fiber?
We do that with a second device that we've invented called a trusted exchange. What that device does is not only repeat the signal, but it has intelligent routing built into it. So, for example, let's say that I've deployed this trusted exchange in a mesh-type network or a hub-spoke-type network, and I wanted to get from exchange point number 1 to exchange point number 10. The intelligence built into these exchange devices would determine the least distance path to get between 1 and 10, or it could be based on a different parameter. So, for example, the route that had the least amount of traffic on it or something like that. So we have been able to overcome the point-to-point issue that was associated with quantum key distribution, again, with this advanced key management system with intelligence built into it.
So are you using standard telecoms protocols? Because if we look at data routing at the moment, we've got shortest path first. We've got other mechanisms of determining what is the right path. In particular, some of those are used to make sure that certain types of traffic don't travel through certain parts of the global telecom network that are considered dangerous. Or have you actually created your own protocols?
We have created some of our own protocols because, again, quantum keys are delicate and they have to be handled in a way that doesn't cause their quantum states to collapse. So, yes, but they do derive much of their facility from standard telecommunications procedures.
You've talked a couple of times about the risk of people tapping and bending and what you've been doing. As you move out then onto third-party networks, even though you've got a device, how much risk is there of you seeing attacks against the keys being transmitted? And where do you see those attacks coming from? Is this intelligence community-based? Is this coming from hacking groups?
Part of the big problem today is that there are harvesting attacks going on all the time. And a harvesting attack takes advantage of the fact that today telecommunications data is transmitted along with the cryptographic key. And the cryptographic key today is usually an RSA 2048 key, a very big key, a key that standard computers are unable to factor. But let's remember that just a year or so ago, an RSA 768 key was factored. So what countries like China are doing, they're harvesting data along with the key and storing it and saying, well, you know, I can't break the key today, but I'm working on a quantum computer that is going to be able to break this key at some point. We're not immune from this problem just because there isn't a quantum computer today that can break a large cryptographic key. I like to not argue about whether a quantum computer that could do that will be here in 3 years, 5 years, or 10 years. I think it's safe to say it will be here sometime. There's data that has a long shelf life and has a lot of value. Being able to harvest that today and read it tomorrow is not a very good outlook. The only thing available today that can prevent that is a quantum key. Because if you harvest a data stream with the quantum key, you've changed that quantum key. In years to come, when you say, oh, good, I've got this Office of Personnel Management database on 30 million federal employees, now I'm going to crack it and look at it. If it had been transmitted with a quantum key, once they begin to look at the quantum key, they'll find that that no longer opens anything. You can future-proof secure communications today with quantum keys and nothing else. NIST is building a very important project on post-quantum cryptographic algorithms. There are 26 algorithms left to investigate out of the 82 that were submitted in November of 2017. It's estimated that those 26 algorithms will take another 3 years to cull them down to the two or three that will become the new encryption standard. We can't wait 3 years and allow China and other nefarious actors to steal important data. So there is something we can do about it now. And eventually, when NIST comes out with that standard, I think it'll be a much better standard if it includes quantum keys. We'll see where that goes. But that's very important work, but it's not here today, and we need to do something today.
When you're talking to customers about the harvesting challenge, how many of them recognize that including the key with the data is the problem, and therefore sending the key out of band actually has a benefit?
they're beginning to recognize that now. And with our trusted exchange product, we are able to route the key totally out of band from the telecommunications link. When you think about trying to synchronize one of a million messages out there with one of a million keys, it really is an extremely difficult, not impossible, because there's a non-zero probability that one could do it, but it's as close to zero as I think one would need. So I think people are recognizing that there are ways to really secure their transmission with quantum keys, with key material that's derived from a quantum random number generator, so it will have the maximum entropy of any key available today. And when you combine that with out-of-band transmission techniques, it's really quite secure.
One of the challenges to getting enterprises to adopt this type of technology is they see it coming generally with a very large price. But it's not just the price that can put them off. Most of the time, it's complexity. They feel they have to make a lot of changes. They don't have the staff to understand the technology. How far down the line are we to simplifying this, where, as with other things we've now put into our telecoms networks, it's just a box that plugs in and is easily managed?
That was part of our challenge, to come up with a very easy lift for customers. So that means make them change almost nothing. So they don't have to change their telecommunications strategy. They use the same telecommunications they've always used and become accustomed to using. They don't even have to change their encryption. So they've made an investment in encryptors, but most of the encryptor manufacturers have modified their products now so that they will accept a quantum key and do something like an exclusive OR of the quantum key with the internally generated RSA key. Now you've got this hybrid key that, if anyone observes it, the quantum part of the key will go away and the key will become useless. It's a really easy lift for a customer to implement this. Many of the forward-leaning companies that we're talking to in the financial sector and, of course, in the U.S. government are opting for proof-of-concept trials and are getting ready to implement this technology in advance of a quantum computer that can break their current encryption. Being able to do that and do it on a schedule that isn't a panic schedule is pretty important, and I'm seeing more and more companies adopting that philosophy.
You've solved some of the big challenges that we've worried about over quantum keys for a while. What is left to be solved to make this almost a generic technology, the automatic technology choice?
The direction we're pointing to is a quantum internet that will be upon us when we really have quantum repeaters. And a number of universities are working on that, but it's still a laboratory experiment at the moment. A quantum repeater will be akin to a 2-qubit quantum computer. And there are multiple qubit quantum computers today. I believe that the same timing associated with building a quantum computer that will be able to factor a large number is about the same timing that a quantum repeater will be available. That's probably 5 years in my estimation.
One of the risks we have with cryptography is governments. Governments don't like it because it means they can't look at what people are doing. You talked there about the idea of a quantum internet. The first thing I can hear in the back of my head is politicians standing up and asking for a back door into the quantum internet. How do we make this a reality, but at the same time back off all those people who think that it's going to be the end of the world as we know it, and avoid a massive technology clash between governments who believe they need the access, and there are good cases for some of the reasons why they ask this, but also people who just simply want privacy?
This is a great question and not an easy one to answer, because if you look at the history of encryption, and it goes back to the mid-70s when Whitfield Diffie and Marty Hellman came up with public key cryptography, and IBM came up with what was eventually called DES-56. That project at IBM was called Lucifer, and it was a 64-bit protocol. At least the way the story goes, the NSA insisted that it become a 56-bit protocol. One could only imagine that it had something to do with their ability with their computers to crack 56 but not 64. There are a number of good reasons for the government being able to access this sort of traffic. For example, in the CALEA laws, where if there's been a crime committed, you're able to break into a telephone conversation to get the evidence associated with it. There, I can see both sides of it. I think it will be a technological challenge to be able to get raw output from a quantum repeater, but that work is yet to happen, so we'll have to wait and see what is available to allow that to happen.
Future sounds exciting.
Yes.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.